This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, this is Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today we continue our series, Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing. We'll be talking about a brave new world of science and the definition of the human with writers Tom Wolfe and Margaret Atwood. But first, this is Irish novelist John Banville, author of Shroud, published in paperback by Vintage. I spoke with him in Dublin in 2004 during the celebration of the 100th anniversary of Bloomsday.
When I look inside myself, I don't find a John Banville. I'm speaking as an artist, not as a man. There are always two people speaking here. I increasingly come to the conclusion that there is no self, that there is an infinite succession of selves. If you were to classify my writing, it is post-humanist. Mm-hmm. It does not regard human beings as the center of the universe. This seems to me a post... This seems to me a hangover from our good old religious days. So many of our seemingly secular ideas are in fact just spilt religion. I don't think human beings are the center of the universe. I think that we are, well, I never like to say this, but I believe it. I think we are simply the most successful virus that this world has ever known. And I suspect that bigger and better viruses will do us in the end. The world would probably be a better place without us. But that great, beautiful, tender, delicate experiment that we were will have been marvelous. I would like to think there will be people on Cygnus X3 or somewhere who will be able to remember what we did. But I don't think that we are as important as we think we are.
That was John Banville. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Tom Wolfe, whose most recent novel is I Am Charlotte Simmons. He's the author, of course, as well, of Bonfire of the Vanities and The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and A Man in Full, The Right Stuff, The Painted Word, books really that have not only reflected but shaped the culture of their time. In a certain way, many people have gotten the news of where they live from Tom Wolfe. And I thought, since we're doing this series about identity, that it would be extraordinary to be able to talk to him, because he is perhaps the most incisive writer on American identities that we've known in the last 50 to 70 years. It's extraordinary work. Now, I think that there are a lot of people who, having been living in America, are uncertain, find themselves more than ever incapable of understanding the evidence being thrown up around them about who we are, about who kids are, what they're thinking about. How did you decide to work on a novel that would take place at an invented college?
Yeah, I became interested, talking about identity, in having a heroine, in this case an 18-year-old named Charlotte Simmons, from a remote town in western North Carolina, up in the Blue Ridge Mountains. It's called Sparta. It exists. There is a Sparta. I had to invent the university, but this Sparta exists. And identity is constantly on her mind. Here is a girl whose father is an unemployed factory worker. Her mother is an evangelical Christian, if you know that word has been in the all around the in the last presidential election. And she's been sheltered by her mother. It's very moralistic. She does not travel with the fast crowd in her high school, but she is supremely bright. You know, 1600 on the SAT. She's a presidential scholar. There are only two from each state each year. So she realizes that she is different from the other people in her high school. But she attributes this entirely to her intelligence, her mental superiority. And throughout the book, she keeps reminding herself when she's up against people who she can't figure out, well, I am Charlotte Simmons. And this is her constant reassurance in her mind. I am Charlotte Simmons. I don't have to worry about this pressure and that pressure. Only to find out that so much of her identity does come from home and from people that she thought that she was superior to. And the university, which I had to make up university. I visited universities all across the country, but I call it DuPont. It's smack up against the slums of Chester, Pennsylvania. And it's a very cosmopolitan, prestigious university on the order of Harvard, Yale, Stanford. But it's full of people totally unlike herself. And the big question becomes, can she maintain this identity she thinks she has, that she seems to be so sure of, amidst people whose cultures are so different from hers?
Now, there are two, you'll pardon my choice of words, very dear people in the book. One is Charlotte, of course, and the other is Jojo. And they're both people who, for various reasons, come to believe in their experience at college, or at least if they were to take it seriously. Jojo is the one white basketball player on his team, in the starting team. And Charlotte casually and inadvertently disses him because she catches him pretending to be stupid in front of his teammates during a class, and she knows that he started out with the answer about Emma Bovary, but by the time that he's finished answering the question, peer pressure, as she considers it to be, has made him give a dumbbells answer. He likes her. In fact, there's something about this kind of woman who's demanding that he stop being a guy that really turns him on. She seems to turn everyone on, actually, but in the case of Jojo, you really feel it's true love. He's been looking for someone to instruct him for a long time, and he seems to be looking for an old-fashioned American schoolmarm in a certain way, mm-hmm. that this is an aspect of culture that can raise a person to have identifiable knowledge and therefore an identity itself.
In my particular story, it is stimulated by the fact that a pretty girl, instead of going along with the gag that I, a great basketball player, I'm above learning anything. In fact, I make a joke of it, and you're supposed to laugh with me when I do that. But he also has a brother who has gone in a professional direction. He's gone to Northwestern. He's become a lawyer. And Jojo always feels that he's long ago now surpassed his brother because he became a basketball star. And he got lots of ink. That's the expression they use for press covers. and his brother never got any ink for anything. But he realizes when he talks to Charlotte Simmons that, in fact, he has been living simply by peer pressure of one sort or another. Incidentally, this is very, very common among basketball stars. It starts in high school. They are led to believe that they are already superior to every other student because they can perform athletically in a way that no other students can. And it's very sad to see these young men end up at college. There's so many stories that we read in the press about what academic casualties they are. It's very, very sad to see this happen because in many cases they are not as stupid as they seem when they reach college. If they had ever been forced or had allowed themselves to learn, when you can go through high school as a great athlete and turn your books upside down in class and pretend to read them and everyone will laugh at what a funny fellow you are and what a superior being you are, you take the easy way out. You do that. It's a lot easier than reading those books and performing well academically.
Let me identify myself. I'm someone who sometimes asks professors or editors or even sometimes writers, how does it feel to be playing an active part in the death of your own culture? And there are not very many people still who are willing to, you know, stand up to the plate and acknowledge that whatever they meant to be doing, that this is in fact what they've done, presided over the death of culture and consequently of identity. And, you know, as a result, when I'm reading a book like I Am Charlotte Simmons, and there's a young man who's convinced by a young woman that he ought to be reading Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and does so, against the coach who doesn't want him to and the people who tell him that, you know, these courses weren't made for people like you. In other words, I found this book as being, what is that word, hortatory, meant to encourage the things that would be taken as the old-fashioned values of a liberal arts college education.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Tom Wolfe, author of I Am Charlotte Simmons, published by Farris, Straus & Giroux. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking with Tom Wolfe.
Now, in the book, a professor of neurophysiology evolves the idea that what with genetics and environmental configurations, that a person may well be imagined as being like a thrown stone, mm-hmm. given consciousness in mid-arc, therefore thinking that he's capable of making the decisions that lie ahead of him, but in fact it's just gravity and trajectory and force. It seems as if in the absence of what you could have conventionally called identity, making choices, etc., that you are left. In other words, if the brain isn't pulling the bow back, mm-hmm. you know, and creating enough strain so that you are redirecting your own arrow, you are a thrown stone, it seems to me. and that this book is about, in many senses, what happens to people with no more intentionality than a thrown stone. The primary argument in the book for the college students is everyone else does. And the epigraph to the book talks about the formation of extreme erotic behavior in cats, even normal ones, if they're placed among cats that have been operated on so that their behaviors become extremely neurotically active. The suggestion is that develop a neurotic character of any kind, and eventually everything around it will be warped by it. And I'm curious whether, in fact, you think so.
I do. I now agree with Jose Delgado, one of the first great neuroscientists, although he wasn't called that. He was a brain physiologist from Spain, did some of his greatest work in the 1950s. And it was his conviction that the Indians in the Vermelho Valley of the Amazons were right when they said there's no such thing as yourself. He was the first to put self in quotation marks whenever he used it. And you have no soul. That would be the first thing that the neuroscientists would laugh at. And there's really no capital I inside of your skull. I've always thought that I had something akin to a brass crucible inside of my head, and that you could do anything to the rest of me, but I would still be me, and I'd still be in there. And he says, dream on. He said, your mind, yourself, is like a lobby into which anyone can come, and the environment can come in too. I mean, plants can grow. He said, every human being is a transient composite of elements of the environment. And that, of course, is not only a frightening conception of oneself, it's also unbelievable. I simply can't conceive of not being me. I think most of us can't conceive of that. Well, the neuroscientific argument is, nevertheless, you aren't you. You are a mechanism. There is no ghost in the machine who is directing the activities and giving you free will. I mean, so the bottom line is, you don't have free will. You think you're making decisions yourself, and you're not. And you are the rock that has been thrown and given consciousness in midair, and now thinks it has free will. Will and can come up with a fabulously logical, highly rational arguments as to why you've chosen this direction on your own, even though you're just a trajectory. This, I believe, is gradually becoming the human being's conception of itself. This hasn't fully developed yet, but it's rapidly developing. And it eventually is going to create a sort of hopelessness that people will be unable, I think, to deal with. I mean, to finally believe that they are right, that they, the neuroscientists, are correct, and that I am just a machine, and one day I sit down with Michael Silverblatt, and each of us thinks that he is a sentient being with great choices to make and great directions to open in the life of, let's say, literature. You're just kidding yourself. You here you are, you intersect, your lives intersect, and it's already predictable exactly what you're going to do. In fact, I was talking to one young neuroscientist. They're the ones who come right out with these things in bald-faced sense, who told me that eventually when we get enough parallel computers, don't ask me to explain what parallel computers are, but they already exist, that will give us sufficient data, we'll be able to predict out as long as about a month everything that you will do in that month, down to such things as, in 5 seconds you're going to touch your forehead and scratch. This will be the ultimately frightening conception of humankind.
Now, within that scheme of people who have discovered that there is no self, here's Tom Wolfe sitting across from me. What is the impulse to be Tom Wolfe tomorrow, next week, last year, the man in the white suit? Does that amount to creating a continuity as opposed to a self?
Now that you bring it up, I don't even claim to understand me. I think I'm as much a puzzle to myself as other people are puzzles to me. And I'm not saying that I believe the neuroscientists are right. All I'm saying is that they are having a bigger and bigger influence, and we're going to hear more and more about ways in which we really have no choice in what we do. After all, the great figure in neuroscience right now, Edward O. Wilson, a nice Alabama boy who ended up at Harvard, has summed up the case in, I think it's two sentences in an interview. He said, "The human brain is born not as a blank slate waiting to be filled in other words, not a tabula rasa, but as a negative waiting to be dipped into developer fluid." Implication is you may develop that negative well, you may develop it poorly, but you're not going to get anything beyond what's already in that brain when it's born. And of course, now he's talking about genetic capability and things of that sort. When that belief finally takes hold, it's bound to bring about a great psychological depression. And this is another thing that Charlotte Simmons vastly admires Victor Ransom Starling, the Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist at DuPont University. And yet his theory is something that frightens her, makes her very uneasy.
That there is no ghost in the machine.
That is right. That there there is no ghost in the machine. But when I think about all this, I tell myself, however, even if they're proven correct, I'm going to have a lot of fun writing about them.
That was Tom Wolfe. I spoke with Margaret Atwood in 2003 upon the publication of her dystopian satire, Oryx and Crake, available now in paperback from Anchor. The novel takes place 20 years in the future when gene splicing is on the rampage and new species of human beings are being developed every day. We discussed whether the meaning of language itself is in jeopardy.
One of my great heroes growing up and now was George Orwell, and we think of his writing on the English language and why it is important to use words precisely, appropriately and eloquently. And once that goes and you've got nothing but the inventions of advertisements and politicians, we're in trouble because you can no longer name things for what they are. And when everything is for sale, there is no free zone for the imagination left, because it's all hype and it's all competition to make the next thing, but it's also competition to make the next way of selling the next thing.
Nevertheless, one senses in this book that the book is the product of an intuition that when language and culture have been so demoralized, that it is scientists who begin to invent pigs in which human organs can be bred and multiplied. In other words, we need surrealism, we need imagination, and if we are not willing to let our writers talk to us about the impossible, our scientists will rush into the gap and make it.
Oh, they're already doing that. The pig is with us, the pig that will grow organs. And the luminous green rabbit, which in my book has got out and interbred with the wild rabbit population, the luminous green rabbit already exists. We now have the capability of making all kinds of new creatures very quickly. Nature has made them in the past, but it's taken nature millions of years to make new creatures. We can now do it in a year. You know, we now know how to do that. And believe me, people are going to go to town with it.
Oh, yeah. The future is here, and we are living, you know, as if it has not arrived and as if this is news to us. Oryx and Crake, on the other hand, you know, is a wake-up novel to some extent, and it wants to make readers do something. What?
Ask questions. First set of questions, where are we going? Second set, do we want to go there? Third set, who are we as human beings? And fourth set, how far can we change ourselves without crossing that line? You know, how far can we go without becoming something not really human anymore? So all of these things, all of these questions have been raised before, now and then, here and there. We're now at a point in human history at which we can actually realize a lot of our desires. We used to project them in the form of mythologies. You know, you can have a flying horse and fly around in the sky, or angels with wings, and people who live forever. Although those people who live forever, the story was seldom a happy one.
That was Margaret Atwood talking about her novel Oryx and Crake, out in paperback from Anchor. My other guests were Tom Wolfe, author of I Am Charlotte Simmons from Farrah, Straus & Giroux, and John Banville, author of Shroud from Vintage. This special series, Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing, is produced by Michael Silverblatt, Melinda Siegel, and Alan Howard. The engineer is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.